Welcome to the holiday special Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. Today, we'll hear from county firefighters reflecting this past year's massive wildfires.
I think it's absolutely critical for the communities to be involved with their fire departments.
And about some food sovereignty projects on the Wind River Reservation.
It takes a community. That's how we move forward, is with the community.
And we'll tag along with a longtime Sublette County local for a very unique kind of Christmas tree hunt.
Look at that big one there, full of berries. Should we go over there? Just look.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
The Modern West is resharing our ranching series, The Great Individualist. This time, on their Colorado ranch, the May family is working to protect the native prairie. So instead of plowing the land, they sell carbon credits.
I guess it was just starting to be some awareness of the importance of short grass prairies and the diversity that we have.
A Promise Never to Plow. It's part 9. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to the holiday special Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Many Wyomingites are looking back and trying to make sense of this year's wildfire season. The state saw 2,000 wildfires with over 850,000 acres burned, and most of that land was private, which complicated recovery efforts. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger sat in on a recent meeting of county firefighters and officials in Casper discussing what they learned.
Large fires. They do not go out on a lot of fires. You need to train your folks, to write legibly.
Chris Thomas, Sheridan County's fire warden, speaks to a room of well over 200 firefighters. Some listen intently, some distracted on their phone, some taking a power nap. Understandably, attendees are tired and still dealing with the aftermath of a fire season officials described as historic.
And we've heard other people say, how do you train for a 100,000-acre fire that's moving at 40 miles an hour? You don't even think of things like that. Well, now we do, because we've seen it. But I definitely think there are a lot of lessons that people learn from this. There are a lot of reestablishment of relationships and working together. We all work together very well, but it's helped to refresh a lot of that stuff.
Tom Lubis with Crook County Volunteer Fire was on the ground fighting some of these blazes. He said that the length of the season and the size of some of these burns took him and his crew by surprise. He said it was also an opportunity to re-engage with the people that his crew serves.
The building of relationships, that is definitely one of the positives this season, was with that large amount of activity. Following a couple of slower fire seasons, a lot of relationships with local landowners and stuff were able to be built or reestablished because, you know, the slower fire seasons the last few years, we weren't getting those interactions. And now those are back, which is a positive.
And that was the big takeaway from the conference. Fire departments were suddenly scrambling to distribute up-to-date, accurate information to the public as conditions on the ground frequently changed. Some private landowners initially didn't want to work with fire departments. Others were eager to help, even if it was at the wrong place and time. Some departments reported combating misinformation about evacuation orders. Others reported dealing with public alert systems that couldn't reach landlines.
I think it's absolutely critical for the communities to be involved with their fire departments. And when a large
Chad Cooper, president of the Wyoming Fire Board, says this is the time to work on outreach and communication.
And when a large incident happens, it's so critical that we work together, that we have consistent messaging and go to a known source. So there's always going to be a public information officer or some sort of an official means of notification from the incident, and just encourage the public to follow that official information and to avoid speculation about what the fire is doing.
Cooper also highlighted things homeowners can do on their own to prepare.
The last thing is that I'll hit on really hard is it's so important that you prepare before the fire happens, because there's all kinds of risk reduction strategies and ways to reduce hazardous fuels and harden your homes to reduce the risk from ignition on your home. And it's important to do that, when there's not smoke in the air, when there's not a fire coming towards your home.
Any other questions, Amy?
If future fire seasons resemble this year's, then fire departments in Wyoming will need more support, manpower, and funding.
Probably the biggest takeaway is we're going to have active fire seasons every now and then, and we need to support the firefighters if we can.
James Reitz, also on the State Fire Advisory Board, said that this is the message he's taking from the conference to the legislature for next year's fire season.
We're getting stretched pretty thin on our fire departments, and volunteerism is down statewide, and we really need to support those and help them wherever we can.
A couple engines here and there is not going
to
help you.
Wyoming firefighters are proud to say, despite costly and extensive property damage, there was no loss of life. In fact, according to Chris Thomas, one man experienced a moment of miraculous hope, even when he was surrounded by scorched earth.
I had one other rancher. The hillside was black, and here come probably a half dozen of his old cows through the black coming out to him, and he broke down and cried, because his girls made it and were coming home. Yeah, it was just like he was just so happy because he figured everything had been lost. But they apparently found some place up there to hide and said, okay, it's clear. It's time to come home, guys. We're going and we're going to make it.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Uplinger in Casper. We like to give souvenirs.
It's been about a year since Teton County Search and Rescue was able to add a multi-million-dollar helicopter to the organization. The chopper is a rare addition for a volunteer search and rescue group in the West. They're just too expensive. But Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Philpula-Inkney reports the costly addition is helping rescues in Teton County and across the region.
Teton County Search and Rescue's weekly trainings look more or less like this. It's less than an hour until takeoff. Six volunteers slip in harnesses and insulated layers at the building overlooking Jackson. Carabiners, slings, and a good amount of gear and gadgets hang from their hips. Today, short haul training, a rescue technique that requires hanging a person from a line directly beneath a helicopter for transport to a safer location.
It's a pretty straightforward day.
30 minutes until takeoff. The group circles up to go over the plan and any risks they may encounter, like weather or hunters and hikers in the area. They decide the potential for something to go wrong is pretty low, but remember, close to the helicopter, away from the rotors.
I'm good to go.
Good to go.
Good to go.
Go.
Good.
Yep.
Okay.
15 minutes until takeoff. Helicopter pilot Steve Wilson opens the hangar door, then uses a remote-controlled landing platform, a heli wagon, to wheel the custom helicopter outside beneath the patchy clouds it'll fly into. He looks over the multi-million dollar ride. The other volunteers follow suit, running their hands over all sides of the aircraft from top to bottom, end to end, before sliding into their seats. T-minus 2 minutes until takeoff. Wilson's in the cockpit. He starts the helicopter and the blades start turning, slowly, gaining speed with each revolution. Wilson has worked for Teton County Search and Rescue for 6 years, but he's been flying for decades. He's part of the team that spent years planning how to get their own helicopter.
It's like getting a new toy for Christmas.
It's necessary, they say, to meet the increase of rescue calls as the county continues to grow and more recreationists file into the backcountry.
So year-round, 365 days a year, we can respond to any needs that this community has.
Over a year ago, nabbing a helicopter might have been simple if one was under lease, but it also could have raised the stakes of a rescue if one was elsewhere, requiring a cascade of phone calls to partners like the Forest Service to find the closest ship.
But every time we needed one, it was like banging on your neighbor's door, borrowing a lawnmower.
That's Cody Lockhart, chief advisor for SAR and a lifelong Jacksonite. He's been with the organization for about 15 years.
And now it's as simple as like the bell goes off, the phone rings. We just go down to SAR headquarters. There's like a pilot and a helicopter there. They're ready to go. You know, we kit out the helicopter and the team for the specific mission and we just go. And so that whole big piece of logistics that went into the front end, a lot of these rescues is gone.
In Colorado, a state that responds to some of the most search and rescue incidents in the U.S., there's not a single volunteer search and rescue operation with its own helicopter. That's according to Colorado Search and Rescue Association. They say it's a money thing, especially for those without a special foundation. The prospect of buying a helicopter, slim to none. But through community donations, Teton County's Search and Rescue Foundation was able to raise over $7 million in less than a year to buy their own custom-made search and rescue helicopter in its largest capital campaign ever.
I mean, there definitely are some economic realities to living in Jackson Hole. Like, the money was here, and so they were willing to come to the table and pony up.
The organization flew 67 missions in the first year with the new ride, over double the trips in 2023. But rescues themselves didn't double. Teton County Search and Rescue just had more capacity to help out other search and rescue operations. About half of those missions were in partnership with Grand Teton National Park and the Jenny Lake Rangers. They flew missions in Idaho, Colorado, and Yellowstone National Park. Rescues outside the county, Lockhart says, are only conducted when it's not needed in the county, and the extra trips don't cost Teton County taxpayers extra. In fact, it actually helps relieve the financial burden of upkeep and maintenance.
Taxpayers are paying for this helicopter one way or the other, but it helps when we get federal dollars in there, not just county dollars.
Lockhart says the helicopter not only helps Teton County, but the entire region.
We definitely saved a bunch of lives.
Time for takeoff. Heli pilot Steve Wilson is slowly lifting the helicopter from the landing pad, pushing a gust of air strong enough to knock someone from their feet. About 50 feet up, the helicopter leans back, flips around, and within the minute, it becomes a speck of black among grays and blues. Wilson radios back to dispatch from the air.
Good morning. We are off the SAR hangar for Munger Mountain with six souls on board. 1 hour plus 40 on the fuel. Be about 5 minutes in route, and we'll be up here for the next hour or so doing some training.
He says the job is demanding. He makes sure he's always 15 minutes away from the facility in case a call comes in. And it's risky at times, say flying in hazardous winter weather. But his favorite part of the job?
I've been fortunate enough to fly in some of the most beautiful places, you know, on the planet, I feel, and there's no better place than here in the Tetons for me.
As the valley heads into winter, tucked in beneath a blanket of snow, SAR hopes they don't have to use it. But winter in Jackson Hole is a busy season, so they inevitably will. And when they do, the new blades will be there. Dante Fopula-Inkney, KHOL News.
Up next, we'll learn about efforts to increase access to Indigenous traditional foods on the Wind River Reservation. This is Open Spaces.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide three music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. How many hands does it take to make choke cherry jam? For this year's special batch for Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone elders, many. That's according to the Tribal Relations Specialist for the Food Bank of Wyoming.
Dos nete ena, nanana na dethuni base, he nana e nina. Hello, my English name is Jacqueline White. My Arapaho name is Singing Crane Woman. I am Northern Arapaho.
White is also part of the Sweetgrass Food Lodge, a group working to build permanent food lodges on the Wind River Reservation. Her passion? Increasing access to traditional foods. She says this goal is possible because of collaboration. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman talked to White about the role of community in a few local food sovereignty projects.
Last year, I started visiting with Morgan Cowley from the Wildlands Restoration of Volunteers in Longmont, Colorado. They wanted to know how we can partner, how we can work together. And Colorado is our Arapaho homelands. And we're always talking about traditional food and how we could obtain our traditional foods for our indigenous people here on the Wind River Reservation. She had a group of volunteers that went through and picked 78 pounds of choke cherries. They cleaned them and bagged them and froze them. And then when they were able to come up, they delivered them to us. So that's how we got the choke cherries. And the idea was to have something special for our elders because they are our knowledge keepers and we have that ultimate love and respect for them.
Can you share a little bit about the significance of choke cherries?
Around here, we have our choke cherry season and they're hard to obtain because of certain areas and locations where they may be overpicked. And we utilize those choke cherries in our ceremonies. We don't just like prepare them and cook them to be cooking them. There's always an intent and a purpose behind that. And as we're doing things, we're praying for the purpose of why we're harvesting them. We're praying for the purpose of why we're preparing them and those good blessings that we want for the people that will partake it, and especially for whatever ceremony we're preparing them for. So we also partnered with the Wind River Food Sovereignty Project with Kelly Pingree and Libby Lewis, where they provided the supplies for us. The Sweetgrass Food Lodge board members came together and volunteered to make the choke cherry jam. The awesome reviews we got from elders or people in the community that received that choke cherry jam was enormous. We had elders saying that it was something that their grandmother or their mothers used to make and that they haven't had it for a long time. And, you know, it just really was special.
You also worked with Jason Valdez at the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative and Dennis O'Neill with the Northern Arapaho Tribe to harvest 2 buffalo for the monthly food distribution in November. What was that process like?
We gathered at the Arapaho site, the tribal buffalo enclosure. Indigenous people don't just take an animal. There's a process and there's a prayer and there's protocols that are involved. You know, we harvest that sacred buffalo that is giving their life so that we can have life. And that was really important that we followed our traditions and our cultural way of life, that that we honor that buffalo that way. Then the next day was the Wind River Tribal Buffalo Initiative Buffalo Harvest. That was another amazing experience. We did the same thing there. Everything was done with prayer and there was a lot of people that came together. And I was just really impressed because the generosity and the good heart and the good intentions that people put into harvesting those buffalo. You know, there's skinning it and gutting it and processing and taking it to the processor and then have it prepared and ready and frozen for our mobile food pantries that we distribute that meat in. You know, that's a service that we provide from the Wyoming Food Bank. All that started 4 years ago with this, we call it CARFI, but it's called Culturally Responsive Food Initiative. And what we did was we surveyed our tribal members, Shoshone and Arapaho tribal members. What are your traditional foods that you utilize, that you want? Because we're not your typical mobile food pantry where we just like, well, here's a box of food, here you go. But it's more catered because we want to provide foods that people are going to utilize.
Can you talk a little bit about the role of community and collaboration when it comes to supporting food sovereignty?
It's important that we do everything from the community. So it's coming from them in the community, not us coming into the community saying, this is what we're going to do for you. This is what we want. No, we want to know what you want. What's important to you? I was told from William C. here, he said, you are so very fortunate. There is no greater honor amongst our Arapaho people than to give one another food.
You've dedicated so much of your time to increasing access to traditional foods. What are some of the barriers to accessing those foods?
The biggest challenges that we have here are transportation and access.
and we don't have food pantries here. And that's a huge one. We're working on that. One of our goals, our number one goals, is to have food pantries here on the Wind River Reservation in locations that people have access to, in Fort Washakie, Itati, Arapaho, St. Stephens. So the challenge is finding a building. And we have large families. We do our mobile food distributions every single month, and we have up to 20 people in one household.
Jackie, what keeps you coming back to this work day after day? What motivates you and inspires you?
My motivation and inspiration comes from my late husband, Crawford White, you know, and those teachings that we have to love one another, to help each other and care for each other. Knowing and understanding our Arapaho way of life, how important it is to be helpful to each other, and especially with food, that drives me. I have a dream for us out here to have brand new food pantries buildings out here. And we want to get away from calling them food pantries. We're going to call them food lodges. That's more appropriate for Indigenous people.
Looking ahead to the next year, what are some projects you're really excited about or looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to continued work with our food sovereignty and our traditional foods with wild game, the buffalo, the elk, and the continued partnerships and with people in Colorado with the choke cherries, because that's going to be a continued project. And I'm really excited about it because, like, it's something that we started and I would like to see continue on. I'm really, really excited about the food lodges that we're going to have here on the Wind River Reservation. Of course, it's going to take a huge undertaking with doing a fundraising campaign. And so we're still working on those things as we're waiting for the 501c3 status to come in. That's been a hope and dream of mine to make that happen with those food lodges here.
I've been talking with Jackie White, the Tribal Relations Specialist at the Food Bank of Wyoming. Jackie, thanks so much for making the time to talk today.
Thank you.
The Food Bank of Wyoming collaborated with community members and the Shoshone and Arapaho Fish and Game to harvest 10 elk for the monthly food distribution on the reservation this December. It's that time of year when you go digging through the back of your recipe box for those old traditional family favorites. A lot of times, those recipes come with great holiday stories to boot. Here's a few that Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards collected from our listeners. We start with Shay Howlin from Laramie.
So my story is actually about two recipes, and my mom is a great cook. Everybody would agree. And so one recipe that she has is called Old South Eggnog. And it's delicious, and it is about a third egg whites, a third egg yolks, and a third whipped cream, full of sugar, rum, and bourbon. And it's all whipped together, and it's this frothy, foamy goodness covered in a little nutmeg. Every Christmas Eve, we would have Old South Eggnog, and so one Christmas Eve, this story is when I was home from college. And so you know how you're homesick when you're away from college, missing your mom's food. And so came home from college one year, and my sister and I used to work in the mall over the holidays. So we're exhausted. We come home Christmas Eve, and there's the bowl on the counter. The Old South eggnog is always served in this big punch bowl. And she serves it in these little tiny cups, like crystal, about one inch, they look like mugs, but they're like 1 inch tall. And so not me though, I go over and I get a big old glass and I get the ladle and I stir the eggnog because it separates a little bit. I stir it up and I pour myself a big glass of this eggnog and I take a sip. Wasn't the eggnog. That's where the other recipe comes into this story. Yeast waffles. Also in big and frothy in a big punch bowl, and if you read the recipe, you'll note that we let rise overnight on the counter, and it's a Christmas morning recipe. Both excellent recipes, but only one of them you want to drink out of a glass.
Here's another recipe that secret ingredient is also spirits.
It comes to us from Tim Fennell in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
What we make is a chocolate-covered cherry with a kick. What we do is take Marciano cherries, drain them, and then soak them in whatever you want to soak them in. We normally soak them in, like, Captain Morgan's, and the longer you soak them, the more kick they'll have. We typically soak them for about a month. We take them out of that, and we let them set for a little while on, like, a paper towel, and then we dip them in melted chocolate, whatever you prefer, milk chocolate, dark chocolate. We prefer dark chocolate. I try to get cherries that have the stem on them, and then when you dip them in the chocolate, then we set them in a pan, and they're finger food. So that's what we like to make for Christmas time.
Anna Castro grew up in Jackson, and she remembers this Christmas recipe.
En ponche is traditional to Mexico in posadas. So posadas are an 8-day celebration that happen in Mexico City and sometimes in other parts of Latin America. And people go on the streets and it's a lot like caroling, and there's specific songs that people sing to their neighbors. And the children are all in the street and there's fireworks and lights. Ponche is like a mulled fruit punch. Some people will put alcohol in it, but for the most part, there's no alcohol in it. And it has things like sugarcane and oranges and pears and apples. And it has very specific fruit, but the big, big part of it are the sugar canes. Growing up, my cousins and I would fight for the sugar canes because there's only like a limited amount. And if you got one, you would just take it out of your cup and you can like suck the fruit punch out of it. And it's so fun, it's so delicious. And then you chew on the sugar cane. It's sugary, it's got so much flavor, so what kid wouldn't love it?
And here's Jean Koshnitsky from Laramie with a Lithuanian recipe.
The recipe is called latkes. I think it's like a Jewish tradition. However, in Lithuania, it also was a tradition with our family back in the old country, so to speak. And when my grandparents came over from Lithuania, they continued the tradition for having latkes or potato pancakes on Christmas Eve. That was part of our Christmas Eve tradition before we went to midnight mass. It's basically grated potatoes with milk and eggs and a few little spices in there, and then they're fried. Back in the day, they were fried in lard, which gave them a very distinct flavor. And as a child, I remember having to peel pounds and pounds of potatoes because I lived with my grandmother, and the Christmas Eve tradition was always held at Grandma and Grandpa's house. In our tradition, they were kind of flatter and thinner, crispy, more crispy. The traditional was always sour cream and applesauce were the choices. And it kind of evolved over the course of time. We started doing a little research on what other cultures used for their toppings for potato pancakes. You could substitute like cream cheese for the sour cream and add capers and smoked salmon. Pears and blue cheese was another topping. Our traditional Christmas Eve thing was borscht, the latkes, and some type of smoked fish. And, you know, if we were going to do salmon on it, that would be it. But more likely, we would have herring. But standing next to my grandmother was just kind of fun. I remember having to stand on a chair to be able to reach the stove. So I was probably maybe 5 or 6 when I started doing it with her. We both wore aprons and doing it together. At the time, we would speak in Lithuanian, you know, back and forth. So that was a real treasured memory.
If these recipes got you excited to try making them, you can find them all at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
A University of Wyoming track and athlete star is now competing for the U.S. in the World Cup bobsled circuit. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Radio brings the news to you in our daily and weekly email newsletters. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. A University of Wyoming track and field athlete is trading rubber for the ice. Sadie McMillan is a graduate student who has qualified to join the U.S. national bobsled team. Wyoming Public Radio's Jack O'Neill reports on how McMullen made the transition.
Sadie McMullen used her last year of NCAA eligibility to get her master's in biomechanics and compete for Wyoming one more time. But her last track and field season got cut short when she qualified to represent the United States in the World Cup bobsled circuit.
What gave you the idea to even try out for the bobsled team? It seems a lot different from track and field.
Yeah, it was not on my radar whatsoever until about the end of July. My coach, Quincy Howe, reached out to me, and he received an email from the director of performance for Team USA bobsled. And they were basically just reaching out to different schools, trying to see if there's any athletes that would be interested in trying out for the bobsled team. And Coach Howe was like, you know, I think, Sadie, you would be really good at this. You should give it a shot.
When you got that email from USA Bobsled, what made you think of Sadie?
Her skill level, it was the first thing, I think, in terms of just phenotypically, she had the height and the size and the ability that I know they look for in pushers.
That's Coach Quincy Howe, who has been the jumps coach for Wyoming track for the last 20 years. He recruited McMullen to come to the University of Wyoming as a long jumper and short sprinter. He said her ability fit being a brakeman for bobsled perfectly.
It's one of those things where speed is a huge component in that realm, but also the ability to move heavy things. and she has that in spades.
So McMullen went out to the tryouts in Salt Lake City and Lake Placid. She soon found out that she had made the World Cup team. But University of Wyoming strength performance coach Josh Little wasn't surprised.
We only knew it was a matter of time before she got that call from the coaches to say, hey, we want you. So, of course, it was very emotional for us because we were able to, you know, be excited for her and be happy for her.
Coach Howe had a similar reaction.
You are well suited to this. So I did not expect it to happen this quickly, but I was not surprised at all.
What can you say about Sadie's weight room performance?
Sadie is a unicorn. She is fast. She's explosive. She's strong. You know, she's putting up numbers on her Olympic lift. She's putting up numbers on her squat and her bench. Her vertical, her long jump, her flying 10, all of these things are just through the roof.
Athletic talent is important, but McMullen admits that learning a new sport this late in her career is no easy task.
Yeah, it's been a lot. I was definitely drinking from the fire hose for a month while I was out there. There's so much that goes into it, just the ability to push. So, I mean, track has really translated really well to pushing the bobsled. So they really look at the power aspect of the athlete and the ability to transfer power at a very specific acceleration angle. And that's just something that I've developed over my 10 years of training for track.
Pushing is super important in bobsledding, considering that running on the ice is the first part of the race.
On the women's side, you have two-person bobsled. So you have a pilot and you have a brakeman. And the pilot is the person in the front, and they steer the bobsled down the track. It's quite difficult to be a pilot. And then I am considered to be a brakeman. And so my job is to push the sled as hard and as fast as possible in those first 45 to 50 meters, and then jump in and hold on and pray.
Coach Howe has no worries about McMullen's ability as a bobsledder.
With as novice as she is and as good as she has shown just in the last two and a half months, I really believe the sky's the limit. But the Winter Olympics is right around the corner, and I believe that she has what it takes to make that team.
What has life been like since you've qualified? Are you like walking with a little bit more pep in your step, or like what does this look like for you?
Yeah, it's been really exciting. It's been kind of surreal. Being a professional athlete is something I've dreamed about for a long time, and it is literally a different sled than I thought I would be in.
McMullen will travel to Europe to compete in the World Cup Series. Her first race will be in Winterberg, Germany on December 30th. Then she will travel to four more races in Europe before finishing her season at the World Championships in Lake Placid, New York. All races will be streamed on the International Bobsled Federation's YouTube channel. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jack O'Neill.
To the mountaintops overlooking Laramie. As Wyoming's tourism and recreation industries continue to grow, new trails and outdoor facilities are popping up all over the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Chris Clements straps skis to his boots to take us to the Happy Jack Recreation Area.
There's gigantic lodgepole pines standing at least 60 feet in the air in front of me. The clouds are kind of whirling by. They're going so fast. It's about, 15 degrees. There's not many people around. Everything is dusted with snow. Everything is shimmering. It's sort of a beautiful combination of overcast and sunny, but it's frigid. Frigid. Good. Do you mind if I ask you folks some questions for a news story?
This is a gem up here, Pilot Hill and Ty City, the trails in here. We mountain bike in the summer and cross-country ski and hike whenever we can. It's a destination.
Dan Lynn and his family are out hiking despite the stinging, blustery wind, dogs included.
This is Tesla, the only Tesla we'll ever own.
Mac.
And Winx.
She's the one-eyed wonder. She has one eye, so we call her Winx.
The new investments in outdoor rec, one of the state's fastest growing industries, means more memories for Wyomingites, including for Dan, who says he's got biking memories of these trails he'd rather forget.
I came around a curve too fast and slid out. And I was going for, my head was going for a log, and I knew this was going to hurt, but my helmet saved me. And I crashed on my right side.
A couple minutes later, Laramie resident Don Jones cross-country skis right by me with a Happy Jack crash-out tale of his own.
I think it was when I was maybe either fourth or fifth grade, the elementary school do a trip up here to go skiing, and I was like pretty excited to show off how good of a skier I was. So while my whole class was going up the campground hill, I skied up to the top and then came down and tried to do a big spectacular hockey stop right in front of everybody and just crashed right at everybody's feet.
Right now, a snowshoer or a fat biker could travel from the network of trails that starts at the edge of Laramie all the way up to Happy Jack, about 16 miles. That's thanks to a new connector trail built by Wyoming Pathways, a group that helps communities in the state build trail systems. Mike Kusick is the executive director.
Going back to the 90s, you know, people were riding from town through what used to be called Cactus, which is now Pilot Hill in the schoolyard. And they would go through, at one point they had permission to go through a landowner's property to get up to the radio towers.
That old route is what the new trail is for. There's been a flurry of outdoor recreation projects just like this one built across the state. Kusick credits the Wyoming Office of Outdoor Recreation for helping breathe life into the new connector trail.
Tremendous partners there. They make available $50,000 grants that you can write to either repair existing trail or build new trail that are non-motorized. And we've been doing that for years.
After the last legislative session, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle passed a bill that lays out how a new outdoor rec trust fund will work. It establishes a board that'll meet to dish out its roughly $6 million of funding for outdoors projects. Those could include boat ramps, campground extensions, or networks of crisscrossing trails like this one. It's quiet, except for the sound of the wind moving through the lodge poles, occasionally knocking off snow and creating these great plumes of white powder. That's what it's all about, folks.
That was state government reporter Chris Clements, cross-country skiing at Happy Jack. Last but not least, we head out with a Sublette County local to look for a special type of Christmas tree. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, I speak with Leela Phillip, author of the book Beaverland, How One Weird Rodent Made America.
Encountering the beavers was really serendipity. I was taking a walk with my dog and I wasn't really paying a whole lot of attention. And next thing I knew, there was this bam, like a gun had gone off. It was iconic beaver tail slam.
I'm Megan Feary. Look for a brand new Human Nature episode December 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the holiday special Open Spaces. You might remember last year's holiday show. We featured a story on a very Wyoming kind of Christmas tree hunt for a sagebrush. On the hunt was longtime Sublette County outfitter and mountain man, Bill Webb. Bill is back this year with another unique Christmas tree idea. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan met up with him at his house in Pinedale. Take a listen.
You know who that is?
Oh my god.
You want to leave your dogs here?
Yeah, I thought so.
There's a lot of elk and deer tracks up there and stuff, so we probably ought to leave them all here. We should go to the game and the forest circus. And get a permit. I don't know
yet. Hey guys.
Howdy.
So you're here to get your Christmas tree permit?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, it's $15 for any tree less than 20 feet.
Any tree?
Any tree.
Does that include juniper?
It does. Cash, check, credit card for you today?
Cash.
Okay. All right, Bill, so that tag is yours. You're going to wrap it around one of the branches of the tree as you pull it off the forest. Are you ready?
Born
okay.
Ready.
Go grab that juniper.
Okay, right, see ya. So I thought it'd be kind of fun to get a juniper. You know, move up from sagebrush to juniper. I really like juniper trees. There's a lot of medicinal uses for them, and They got to grow in a certain place. They're around Pinedale, but just in two specific spots. Something in the soil, I don't know why. And they're like a bright green to dull green color. And the females are the ones that get the berries. Just full of these light blue berries, and when they mature, they turn dark blue. Okay. Here we are. Gonna be a little western pulling that sled up this dirt, but once we get up in the woods, we'll need it because there's snow. Okay, any famous last words? Look at that big one there, full of berries. Should we go over there, just to look? Beautiful, healthy, full of berries. Taste one, they're really strong. You know, they're full of seeds. Really a nice, fragrant smell. Smells kind of like gin. And you know why? Juniper berries are used to flavor gin. See? That little scrawny on the tree side, there's one growing right against an aspen tree. That's the kind I'd be looking for. Get one out of there so all the other trees and bushes around it can have more space and grow better. So I'd say this is definitely one to take. Now that's a sock. Okay, here we go. We gotta get rid of some of the other branches. Just call me Snively. Okay. This little tree is a heck of a lot wider than the sled. And we'll be going over snow, but also dirt and rocks. Okay, I am tying one rope across the top part of this tree. Last time I used this sled, why it's got the holes in the rope, I was packing out elk quarters on skis in Bondurant. And so I had to rig it up for that when I was skiing. Okay, down the hill we go. Just enough snow, huh? Life's good. Two beautiful juniper Christmas trees. Ho, 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 hee, hee. Merry Christmas.
That was Sublette County outfitter and Christmas tree hunter Bill Webb getting a juniper. Tagging along and producing the story was Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan. You can listen to last year's hunt for a sagebrush online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edward, today's audio producer, and to Cody Hume, our digital producer and social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.